Hello and welcome everyone to the January session of the Intel Hub, American Public University System, the University of Leicester, and Ray Juan Carlos University are all happy to have you join us today from wherever it is you are tuning in from. I'm seeing a lot of familiar names in the room, so it's wonderful to have our regulars here with us today as this partnership moves into its second year. Today we will have Rob Monks and Terry Pitar speak to us about commercial open source intelligence. Robert has 20 years of experience working in both government and private sector intelligence analysis roles and is currently the editor of Jane's Intelligence Review. He has previously worked as an analyst for the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office and served for 4 years in Brussels as the UK's first national secondee to the EU Intelligence Analysis Center. He has also lectured within the Masters in Intelligence Analysis course at Juan Carlos University in Madrid, Spain, and has been widely quoted in the international media. Terry is a director in Jane's Intelligence Unit. He manages open source intelligence and custom research projects for national security and government clients. He provides clients with threat assessments, horizon scanning, and military capability assessment, as well as open source intelligence optimization support and open source intelligence training programs. For the past 16 years, he served in various investigative consulting roles, including 6 years as an investigative desk officer with the UK Ministry of Defence, 8 years delivering custom analytical products and training within Jane's, and a year as a consultant in the Gulf region. Thank you both for joining us today. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, and for everyone in the room, they will enjoy answering any questions that you might have for them at the end of their discussion.
Nicole, thanks very much. This is Rob Monk speaking. Am I loud and clear? Is that all okay?
Yes, we can hear you perfectly.
Perfect, excellent. So it's good from this side of the Atlantic. Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to speak to Intel Hub, and of course, good day to everybody who's on the call. Just to refresh what Nicole was saying there, that's my biography. I think the point to make is that both Terry and I, we're going to give you a short presentation on how commercial companies provide open source intelligence and just talk about some of the issues around that. The point being is essentially that both Terry and I have worked in the government space and the private space, so we've seen how these processes work on both sides. Terry, your introductory slide.
Sure, yeah, I think Nicole said everything really, but yeah, just to reiterate, as Rob said, we have both got government and private sector experience, and within the role that I'm in now, the essential difference between my role and Rob's position is that I respond to tasking given to us by our customers, and I very occasionally contribute to Jane's Intelligence Review, which Rob runs, and where he's co-opted me as a staff writer on occasion. But yeah, I'll hand back over to Rob, who's going to talk through the first part of the presentation.
So broadly speaking, we'll try and take about 40 minutes to run through three parts of this presentation and then take some Q&A at the end. I'm going to do a section firstly. So what I'll be talking about is what do commercial companies have that potentially are not necessarily available easily in the open source world to actually construct an open source intelligence product. Terry's then going to move on to look at definitions of open source intelligence and some of the ethical and legal challenges surrounding exploitation of open source intelligence. And then I think in the final part, we'll both try and tie that all together, thinking about how the sort of growth in open source intelligence affects that nexus between all of the providers of intelligence, so classified agencies, commercial companies, and indeed academia. So I'll start with a sample of what I've called grey area open sources. So by grey area, a quick definition here, it might not necessarily be the definition that everybody's using, but what we're talking about is open sources that are not easily available. It might be that you have to pay for them, they're behind a paywall, they might be on the dark web, people might be deliberately trying to obfuscate their sources. Or it might be a highly technical source which is only available to a small number of people. And those on the screen now are some of the sources that I will very quickly talk through from top to bottom. It's not the full range of sources that we use in James. There are more, but this will give you an idea of what we, how we approach a problem. Once we have those intelligence requirements, the sources that we can use. And I think at the top of the presentation, it's important to stress that it's the totality of sources that are available that make for a good open source intelligence product. So it's not necessarily relying on one source, but it's bringing together as many sources as you can in the time available to provide that sort of mosaic picture of what's out there. So the first section I look at is commercial satellite imagery. Now, obviously, most of you are familiar with Google Earth. I imagine that there are people on the call who may even have worked in the military and indeed in imagery intelligence. The quotation at the top is very interesting. So it's from the Central Intelligence Agency, and it's from quite a few years ago now. But it's effectively saying that imagery intelligence is almost ceasing to be an intelligence discipline in the government sense of the word, because it's now so widely available. There are four types of different imagery that are available, satellite-based imagery, that we can call on. The first two on the left-hand side there, electro-optical and synthetic aperture radar, are the ones that are most used currently to open source intelligence analysts. The two on the right, thermal and hyperspectral, do exist, but they're currently of less use, so we'll talk about them individually. So just to recap, electro-optical imagery, as I'm sure most of you are aware, it's what you would generally see in a platform such as Google Earth. It works very much like the human eye, like a camera taking a picture from a long distance out, and there are various resolutions of the imagery that are available. The point being here is obviously if you have a paid-for subscription to a commercial satellite imagery provider, then the resolution that you can get and the currency of the imagery that you can get is far better. So obviously the limitations of something like Google Earth are that imagery might not be available recently or it might not be available on the date that you require. That's an example there of some imagery that we have actually published in the past. One of the areas that we look at quite closely, North Korea, and that's showing the Yongbyong experimental light water reactor. The second form of imagery that we can also use, which is available commercially, but as far as I'm aware, only by one commercial provider at the moment, synthetic aperture radar imagery. It's a slightly different way of collecting imagery. If you think back to electro-optical, the problem with electro-optical is that it's like a camera. It can't see through clouds. It can't see through certain atmospheric conditions, and it can't see at night. Now, how do you solve this problem? Well, you can take something like radar imagery, and you can apply that to a particular tasking as well. Radar imagery works in a slightly different way. Electro-optical imagery is essentially passive, whereas with radar imagery, you are effectively beaming down a microwave signal, measuring how it bounces back, and you are directly targeting that to the place that you want to look at. And you can then perform a task called coherent change detection, which allows you to look at a series of images over time, and easily spot things that have actually changed. So again, the imagery that we have on the screen there is looking at the Sohae satellite launching station in North Korea. The big black mass that you see in the center of the image, for example, is seeing inside a particular bay. So that sort of imagery has the advantage of being able to effectively see through certain sorts of materials as well, and give you an idea of what may be inside buildings. Not all materials, but just some. Thermal imagery, as the name suggests, is measuring heat signatures. It's currently, there's very little available in the commercial space at the moment. It's quite large resolution. We've only tended to apply it in a sort of supporting analytical role to support electro-optical imagery, but it can be of use for measuring things such as water effluent, the temperature from a nuclear reactor, and so on. Finally, hyperspectral imaging. Very much, this is a technology that will take off in the future. It's very complicated. I don't pretend to understand all of the science behind it, but essentially, at the moment, it's of less use for us because it's very difficult to take into space as a commercial venture. it requires a lot of data processing, it requires quite large units, and therefore at the moment the commercial provision is actually quite limited. It tends to be used more by airborne platforms, which are then obviously restricted in the particular areas that they can cover. But I do note there that there are potential security and defence applications for it, and it, certainly I think it's one of those things that will probably develop in the future. Just to recap, the other thing that you can do with satellite imagery, obviously, is to geolocate, cross-refer with video, photographs, stills, things that have appeared in YouTube, what have you. So you look at particular topographical features, and you can then compare that to satellite imagery and have a very good idea of where something might have taken place. Very famous cases recently, obviously, from the likes of the investigative outlet Bellingcat. The BBC also did some very good work on this recently as well. So that's just one of the uses of satellite imagery. There's a problem with satellite imagery, it's called persistence, and that is effectively how do you guarantee that you can look at the same place and get as many images of it that you want. At the moment, the cadence that commercial imaging satellites can reach means that you can only probably guarantee that you can get 4 to 10 images per month. Now, what's going to happen in the future with the explosion of small satellites called CubeSats is that you will have an explosion in the constellation of satellites in orbit. We reckon, and this is obviously subject to revisiting, that by the end of the 2020s you will effectively be able to have almost real-time monitoring of almost any point on the Earth. There are also other possible platforms that can be used for imagery. We mentioned here stratellites, which are high-altitude balloons that can also be parked over an area of interest. Let's move on to another potential, what I would call grey area source, automatic identification system. This is what's fitted to ships. Many of you will know it. It's effectively the transponders on ships. Most of them carry them over a certain size. And a lot of the data is freely available on the internet. If you want to have the full set of data, then you need to have a paid-for subscription. And certainly if you want to track back through historical data and look at things that have happened in the past, then you do need to have, it is behind a paywall, so it's what I would call a grey source. What you can then do with that sort of imagery is look at the tracks of individual vessels. As you can see, this is a piece that we did about the Gulf. On the left, those are individual vessel tracks. You can also then apply heat mapping to the same problem to show where you have a certain intensity of vessel passages. You can then, referring back to what I said at the top of the presentation, you can then actually also take a number of other sources, and you can try to track particular vessels using a combination of different assets. So what we have here, effectively, is it's a tug, it's the Nikolai Chika, it's a Russian vessel, and this one actually quite often accompanies the Russian Auxiliary General Intelligence Fleet. And so by tracking this, by tracking its AIS broadcast, you have a very good idea of where it might have been. So, for example, in this slide here that we prepared a couple of years ago, you can look at freely available AIS data, you can look at commercial AIS data, you can look at HF radio broadcasts from the vessel itself, you can look at US Coast Guard position reports, and from all of that you can get a very good idea of the track of a particular vessel. In this case, it was obviously very interested in a launch from Florida, a space launch from Florida. And that's the sort of commercial AIS data that's available and all of the support data behind it. It's part of the company that we work for, IHS Maritime, and access to that significantly improves an OSINT analyst's understanding of global vessel movements. Let's look also at the dark web and social media. Social media intelligence came into its own right as a SOCMINT, it was called. And obviously the dark web has been around for a number of years and is a place where various threat actors congregate. So there on the screen you have examples. We have a number of analysts who have all the right tools to access the dark web. Again, I'm sure that most of you will be aware of the fact that you need to use something like the Tor browser to access the dark web, usually through a VPN, and also taking precautions on your desktop computer, such as having a virtual operating system, to provide all those degrees of cutout from to anonymize the activity that you're performing on the dark web. So here, for example, you have two screenshots of fairly well-known sites on the dark web. We monitor those for things such as trends in the sale of illegal drugs. And quite interestingly there, you can draw certain conclusions. For example, recently there's been a lot of talk about fentanyl and fentanyl consumption in the United States because of the rapid growth in deaths since around about 2012, 2013. A lot of sites on the dark web are actually self-censoring and removing fentanyl as a product listing. But the point about the dark web is that it has attracted a lot of attention from law enforcement, and there have been some well-publicised takedowns, so there are increasing signs that people are moving away from the dark web and towards end-to-end encrypted messaging apps. Social media intelligence, as I said, has been around for a while. This is looking at what people post online and then trying to draw inferences from the connections between different groups of people, and monitoring groups such as far-right groups can give you a good understanding of network dynamics. You can then draw certain network illustrations, such as the one on the left there, which is made using a tool called NIME. You can follow developments on social media, such as advice in the middle there from the Islamic State to its supporters on how to remove a camera from a mobile phone. And indeed looking at the proliferation of recommendations for how to protect communications, looking at new techniques and platforms that threat actors are actually migrating towards. Finally, the Internet of Things. Again, it's Shodan, a search tool, finds vulnerable devices on the Internet of Things, things with poor password protection. And off the back of that, there's been interest in developing scripts. These are often posted to technical sites such as GitHub, and one here that came out very recently, Kamurka 2.0, which allows you to actually search within a geographically defined area for a number of vulnerable devices, such as webcams, and then you can also add in things such as social media posts in the same area. So obviously there's an application there in an intelligent sense for real-time monitoring and situational awareness. However, it relies on a number of vulnerable devices actually being there. And there are obviously some very serious ethical considerations about this as well. Software-defined radios and webcams, I will very briefly touch on. Software-defined radios are web-based. They allow you to carry out remote monitoring as long as you have an antenna in a certain area. You can theoretically from one side of the planet listen to radio transmissions on the other side of the planet. And in its infancy, you can actually begin to aggregate all of these software-defined radios to carry out some fairly rudimentary triangulation, time difference of arrival analysis, very significantly behind military capabilities, but again, it's one of those digital technologies in its infancy at the moment, which is likely to continue increasing in the future. Remote webcams are obviously, as we've discussed, something that can also be of interest to an open source intelligence analyst if they are freely available on the internet and if they are in a position of strategic importance, such as the entry to a port, they can be worth monitoring. For example, to monitor naval vessel movements. On the screen now, you see an example of a webcam that we detected near a Chinese naval base. And about 2 days after we published the article on this particular webcam, which was a tourist webcam showing a beach, this webcam was actually switched off. So clearly it was revealing far too much information as far as the Chinese were concerned. Proprietary data sets. Many companies have these. You can go to many commercial companies and they will provide all sorts of data. A lot of it is linked to geographic information, and that is probably, along with imagery intelligence, the open source intelligence discipline that's been most widely adopted and exploited within the open source community. So the availability of lots of mapping layers that you can add to a visualization to give you an at-a-glance appreciation of a situation. So there, for example, we have a map of Mexico This is proprietary. Collection of events, news events, other data from every point in Mexico allows you to construct a heat map showing the areas of greatest criminal activity. And that is the resultant output. Within James, we obviously have proprietary data sets. We're very famous for being a defense publishing company, originally formed back in the 19th century. So you would expect us to have a military capabilities database, which we do, which lists all sorts of useful information about bases, orders of battles, military around the world. We also have a terrorism and insurgency center, which collates open source reporting on terrorist acts and breaks them down using metadata so that you can tell things such as the sorts of targets that have been attacked, the sorts of weapons that have been used, and so on and so forth. I'll leave there with a fairly rapid run-through, and I do apologize for the rapid run-through of some of those sorts of gray sources that we have. And over to Terry to talk now a bit more about how OSINT fits in with various legal, ethical, and practical considerations.
Thanks, Rob. I think that was a really interesting run-through of some of the lesser or less commonly used sources of information that you can count as open source information. I think we're seeing a huge growth there, which we're going to come on to talk about in part three of this session. But in this part, as Rob mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the definition of open source intelligence. And it might seem strange to raise that at this point in the presentation, but it's something that has recurrently come up for us because the definition of open source intelligence has shifted. And we're going to talk about how some of those changes are affecting us as practitioners and might be affecting some of you in your work as well. So in terms of open source intelligence, you know, there's a fairly general definition we can give it that would be acceptable to most people, where we can say it is intelligence created using publicly available information. And by intelligence, we mean it's processed, collated, assessed information used to answer a specific question. But it comes in a lot of different varieties. More traditionally, and amongst the customers that we work with a lot, you'll see this defense intelligence view where OSINT really supports their strategic assessments, environmental scanning, intelligence preparation of the battlefield, tasks such as those. You'll then see the use of OSINT in investigations and mainly law enforcement agencies where they're using it to augment surveillance. And increasingly, we're seeing OSINT being referred to in the world of human intelligence, now that human intelligence is being brought more and more online with the growth of social media. And OSINT in that sense is sort of a precursor to human activities. And lastly, we see it quite commonly used as a term within cyber threat intelligence, and particularly where organizations are conducting things like pen testing activities, you see the term OSINT used there a lot as well. And I mention these different definitions because we come across customers and clients, and particularly within some of the training that I deliver, people coming onto our courses, and they will all have a different perception of what is open source intelligence based on where they are coming from and the kind of tasks that they're trying to carry out. I also wanted to touch briefly here on the old sort of definition, or as it was depicted in the NATO OSINT handbook from nearly 20 years ago now, but which I think is still worth looking at. And what I like about this is that it shows that at the time, open source intelligence really was considered to be the foundation for other forms of intelligence that an all-source analyst might work with. And it's worth noting that at that stage, there are cracks in those foundations because there was a lot of, criticism that open source intelligence wasn't being used as well as it could have been. That's probably still the case. Some things haven't changed. But what has changed is, this comes up on my slide. Oh, it might not do. I might have lost a graphic here, unfortunately. But what I was going to really depict in that last graphic was that there is a move now, I think, towards incorporating those different forms of intelligence, particularly imagery intelligence and geospatial intelligence, into the new open source intelligence. So more or less reiterating, I think, some of the things Rob has touched on. In this next sort of part, what I wanted to talk about was, again, a bit of the definition around open source intelligence, and just to sort of discuss some of the things that I think slip into the debatable area, where for some people they are open source information and for others they're not. So things like WikiLeaks, you know, some of us might consider information published by WikiLeaks to be open source. For a lot of our government customers, It's most certainly not. Social media. For some organizations, it's fair game. For others, they might look at social media and say, well, up to a point, it's accessible, and where you don't have to log in to any platforms to use it, fine. Once you've logged in, it's no longer considered open source. So different organizations have different sort of red lines about what they consider to be open source information within social media. And that definition is still being either debated or changed, depending on who you talk to. And what about direct messages leaked by Twitter? I don't know, this is sort of a rhetorical question for the audience, really, but would you consider that to be open source information? It's information you can get hold of, potentially, and anyone maybe who's online is able to get hold of, but would you consider it open source information? The same with things like data from fitness applications, Strava being a good example, where the data that was uploaded by users of that application was used in ways that they wouldn't have perhaps anticipated to reveal things that were formally classified. We're going to come on to touch on that in a bit as well. And then, of course, technically, it's feasible to volunteer to create a node on the Tor network. And that could give you access to information which would reveal activity on the dark net, which people may not realize you're getting access to. Again, it's technically feasible, but is it open source information? And I raise this because we had a really great comment, I think, from somebody I was delivering training to recently, from a government organization in Europe, where the open source intelligence team there took more of a, what I would think is perhaps more of a traditional view of open source intelligence, where it is an activity conducted by generalist information specialists who access only the information that's openly available and perhaps commercially available, but without going beyond sort of login pages for social media, etc. So when I was talking to them about social media and I was showing what you can get once you're logged in to platforms like Facebook, they immediately objected and said, hang on, this isn't open source information. You might be able to call this WebInt rather than OSINT, but that's as far as we would go. And the comment they made was, just because it's online doesn't make it open source. I thought it was a very interesting way of perceiving open source information, which is something that is still being debated and still probably shifting in many people's eyes as we speak. I also wanted to touch on where open source intelligence blurs into surveillance. And I've got here some statistics from the UK, which I'm going to touch on in a second. But essentially, what we've seen in some of the research we've conducted about the interpretation of open source intelligence is that, for example, law enforcement agencies, and I'm going to use the UK as an example, but we've seen this much more broadly, they have differing definitions of what is considered open source intelligence. And, for example, in the UK, the guidance given to law enforcement officers is that repeated viewing of, for example, somebody's social media profile would constitute surveillance, for which they would need to get an authorization, in this instance called a directed surveillance authorization. And they've also got to take into consideration that users of social media have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if they don't understand that their information is publicly available, it's not publicly available, or it's going to be considered surveillance if police officers use it in their investigation. So there's a real sort of vagueness to some of these definitions, and legislation covering the issue hasn't kept up with the modern era, and so there's still a lot of uncertainty around how to use open source information, social media in particular, for investigations. But if you've seen the table on the right here, we've listed the number of directed surveillance authorizations issued to UK law enforcement agencies over the last 10 years or so. And you can see immediately that there's been a quite significant drop in the number of directed surveillance authorizations issued. So what this indicates, or what you might think by looking at this, is that police agencies in the UK are conducting much less surveillance than they did previously. Whereas in fact, what's probably happening, and this is slightly speculation in the realm of educated guess, what's probably happening is that things that were previously considered surveillance, for which they had to actually apply for authorizations, no longer are. And it also, they're able to replace some forms of traditional surveillance by using open source intelligence, So for example, rather than having to physically go and confirm that a suspected a business that might be suspected of being used for criminal purposes is in the location that it is, they can potentially confirm that using online information. So there's some interesting things going on here in how open source intelligence is perceived and how it's being used and how practitioners are perhaps using open source intelligence. And this goes not just, this isn't just within the UK, we've seen this elsewhere. There was some really interesting research done in the US amongst law enforcement agencies, which I was hoping to dig out for this presentation, but I couldn't quite find the reference. But it showed that amongst, I think there was a survey done of about 50 different law enforcement, sort of police departments across the US, questioning them on how they use open source information, particularly social media. And there was differences amongst the majority, from what I remember. Or there certainly wasn't a consensus. And I think that this is an issue that's going to have to be looked at in the future amongst law enforcement agencies on an international basis, because, of course, open source information, social media in particular, is borderless. Some other current and future issues that I wanted to touch on in terms of open source information and where we see it going. We've had a lot of talk about the development of intelligence fusion centers over the past, I'd say, probably 10 years, if not longer. And, you know, open source information is becoming a more and more important part of intelligence fusion. The challenge here is that often it's being used, as described in this diagram, you can see in the sort of blue box on the right, it's being used as raw open source feeds going into a fusion process. And that's particularly the case when these kind of fusion centers are being more and more automated. And there's a danger here, particularly with the quality of open source information being affected more and more by deliberate misuse. And we're seeing things like the weaponization of information and more unreliable information being created. So this gives us a few sort of concerns around how open source information is used and how open source intelligence can potentially pollute a fusion process. I think this is a great quote from the RAND Corporation on how information is being weaponized, how it's being manipulated. Now, these are obviously things that have been going on for a long time, but I think the pace and the speed at which information is being created and shared today is so fast that it's harder than ever for anyone to get on top of it. So the challenge there is particularly severe when automation tools are being used, and I think organizations that are using those within a fusion process have to consider carefully how they vet the information, how they assess it, how they process it before it goes into any kind of fusion system. This is particularly pertinent. Again, this graphic is not quite displaying properly, unfortunately. It's a shame. I did have a graphic here on how there are four elements, basically, to what we consider open source intelligence optimization. And these are things that we advise customers on, which I think are particularly important for considering how to improve the way open source intelligence is conducted. And those four things are people, processes, tools, and culture. Anyone familiar with management consulting is going to say, that's pretty straightforward. But I think in open source intelligence, what we've seen is an increasing emphasis and reliance on various different tools to help get on top of the massive information that's out there. And people have been disregarding those other three elements. So things like the processes, if they haven't got the right processes in place, they won't be able to take advantage of the information that's out there. If the people haven't got the right skills and training required equally, they're not going to be able to make the best of it. And increasingly, what they need to have is actually specialist skills, so imagery intelligence skills, geoint skills. They need to have multiple languages available for OSINT teams. So linguists should be in greater demand for OSINT teams than ever before. And these are all important things. And then, of course, the organizational culture is vital within an OSINT team or department. So just some of the things that we are finding, we're talking more and more to customers about. So that was sort of a quick run through of the sort of things that are affecting open source intelligence today. And I'm going to now talk about some of the implications for practitioners and what it means amongst some of the customers that we're working with particularly. So in terms of open source intelligence, I think something that's important to emphasize is that like any type of intelligence, it's vital that it's produced with the audience and the customer in mind. And you've got to bear in mind what it is that your audience, your customer is interested in. So for an organization like ours, as I mentioned in the team that I work in, the James Intelligence Unit, we are directly tasked by customers to produce reports for them. But for a lot of our other products and services that we provide, we need to be very proactively thinking about what are our customers interested in. And we got here an example of a survey carried out by the James Intelligence Review last year, looking at the threats as posed by 17 Western nations. And this was based on analysis of documents that they had published. And we've got here the top three security threats, which are probably not going to surprise many people. But what's interesting is looking at this type of list is seeing the commonalities and seeing the differences, but also trying to understand where some of those threats are ones which are maybe second or third tier threats, and those customers perhaps aren't considering enough. That's where organizations like ours seek to fill that gap. And we do sometimes get customers asking us about threats which are not the sort of amongst those top three. You know, as an example, we're currently working on a project for a government customer, a military customer, where they've asked us to look at the impact of climate change over the next 20 years. So something that could have a huge impact and is probably not yet getting the kind of attention it needs. In terms of open source intelligence, as we've described over the course of this presentation, we're seeing the growth of what is the OSINT space. So things that were previously not considered open source intelligence, things like satellite imagery, increasingly are. And we anticipate that the pool of available OSINT resources is going to continue increasing, so we'll see this trend continue. And we'll start to see we'll continue seeing the expansion of the open source intelligence domain. There's also going to be an evolving sort of client-provider relationship. So open source intelligence isn't going to simply be an afterthought for a lot of customers. It's going to become more and more important for them. And what we've described in this table here is that organizations are moving increasingly from relying predominantly on human intelligence or technical intelligence to actually making greater use of the openly available information that's out there. They're also starting to use tools and methods such as crowdsourcing, or at least they're going to move increasingly towards that, we suspect, to ensure that they're on top of all of the available information that's out there that could affect their decision making. And we've heard recently customers, you know, even still saying to us things like 80% of the information they use is still within the classified domain and 20% is maybe open source. And they're really working hard to try and shift and reverse that ratio so that 80% is open source information. There may be some organizations that are ahead of others in this regard, but it's definitely something that is still being worked on amongst national security and government customers. Now, there's a lot of gray sources, as we've described in this presentation, that are still out there. From our perspective at James, we're often considered as a commercial provider, a gray source of information. We are most definitely not within that classified end of the spectrum. That's something that's obviously within government, the government and national security domain. And what we've seen in the past is a hard boundary between what is open and what is classified. That is something we suspect is going to see increasing leakage of classified information, breaking down that barrier slightly. So we'll see more and more leaks happening. Classified information, we suspect, because the means and the capability of those wanting to leak information will increase. The vulnerabilities will also increase, so it'll be easier for adversaries to get access to government classified information and to potentially leak that information. We'll also see things like new technologies, webcams, as Rob's described, new sensors becoming available that will replace some of what was previously considered classified and create a greater open source information environment. And also, you know, the unintentional use of public information, as we've seen with fitness apps, you know, Strava data being used to identify previously classified military locations. So that's a trend that we think we'll see more of in the future. And on the subject of future trends, I'm going to hand back over to Rob, who's going to talk through a bit of a summary of what we're seeing at the moment.
Thanks, Terry. Yeah, we're up to 40 minutes and we're on to the last slide. So what I wanted to do was then just trying to think about a few of the future trends that we're going to see in open source intelligence. And particularly, probably of interest to people on this call would be where all of the different providers of information actually fit together in the future nexus. So historically, obviously, you have governments with classified intelligence, you have academia providing intelligence studies, you have commercial providers such as ours, and then you have the increasing growth of people who are maybe hobbyists but have access to a certain number of tools. They're quite happy to sit at home, provide their own analysis, put it out on their Twitter feed, and a lot of it can be very good. A lot of it can also be very bad. So thinking about how you draw all of these things together and what are going to be the likely trends in the future, how are we all going to be coming together as different information providers? The first point, I think, fairly obvious, that you have this democratization of intelligence, and it effectively means that lots of organizations are now in the space where they are able to provide levels of analysis that potentially even only 15 years ago would have been the preserve of nation states. Now, obviously, classified agencies are very keen to protect their secrets. They're very wary of doing business with people for obvious security reasons. But we do think that there's eventually going to be this growth of or expanded growth of an intelligence ecosystem around government agencies, which will consist of academia, it will consist of commercial companies, and these will be carefully vetted, obviously, by the classified communities, but there will be a role to play, an increasing role to play, perhaps, in the provision of that sort of information. One thing that we've seen, you will all probably be far more aware of this than I am, but it is the professionalization of training through degree programs. There are obviously a far greater number of degree programs on offer now in subjects such as intelligence and security studies, universities around the world, and nation states actually opening their own intelligence academies to professionalize training and standardize it. So places such as the Académie du Renseignement in France, the Germans have their own equivalent. We understand that the UK is also thinking about the possibility of setting up an academy. So again, that's somewhere where there will be an obvious locus for cross-pollination between academia, commercial providers, and the government community. It will then lead to effectively, we've called it intelligence reservists here. That's maybe not the right term because it implies that they have some sort of formal role and that they might have security clearance. It's not necessarily that. But it is a pool of people who may have worked in government, who may not, but they have the knowledge of what is required by governments to be able to provide that sort of open source intelligence. Terry mentioned there, of course, the risk of security breaches, amply demonstrated by the revelations by Edward Snowden. We can only assess that this is going to increase in the future. And that there will be more breaches, and again, this threatens that delineation between what is effectively open source and what is classified intelligence. So those are just a few of the thoughts that we've had about how this nexus between all of us is likely to evolve in the future. I'd also draw your attention just on the left there, because I've not spoken about it, the graphic. One of the things that's quite interesting at the moment is the willingness of Western intelligence communities to start calling out the activity of their adversaries. And this all basically tracks back to the Skripal poisoning in the UK back in March last year. And we're seeing demonstrably an effort by Western intelligence communities to tackle what they would call adversarial intelligence operations. So this is involved all sorts of things. It's involved publicizing the identities of the people in the Skripal case. It's involved indictments by Mueller. It's involved US Department of Justice indictments. I would say to you that here we have a very, very valuable source of insights into intelligence operations, because the level of detail which is now being disclosed in public documents is probably greater than it used to be. And we carried out a little exercise. We looked at all of the Department of Justice indictments at the end of last year into Chinese espionage, well, alleged, I should say, because it's sub judice, alleged Chinese hackers and intelligence officers. And from that, you are actually able to draw quite a number of interesting conclusions about intelligence activities. We're close there. I think we're 5 minutes over our allotted time for the actual presentation, so that's hopefully not too bad. On the screen, you have our contact details, and indeed the cover of the latest edition of Jane's Intelligence Review, which is just going out today. I'm very keen to hear from people thoughts on what we've talked about during this presentation. Obviously, we have 15 minutes for Q&A, but if you want to actually drop us a line, follow through on any of these things, more than happy to talk. And indeed, you know, I think part of the utility of a presentation like this is we would like to reach out to academia, indeed, a little bit more and formalise some of those links. We're always interested in talking to people from different parts of the community. Nicole, I think that closes our sort of formal presentation. What's the procedure now for Q&A?
Yes, absolutely, and thank you very much for that informative discussion. So I'm taking a look through the chat to see any questions that have come up as you guys were speaking. I know Matt Croston had mentioned when you guys were talking about some of the different ambiguous definitions of terms, asked a question whether or not there was an indication of change in formal law in the UK or a shift in professional practice to avoid a formal law, given the ambiguous nature of some of these terms.
Yeah, I can probably try and address that one, as I touched on it in a recent article for Jane's Intelligence Review, actually. But the law hasn't actually changed in terms of what is covered for surveillance. So the law in the UK, or the law that governs that, is still the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which, if I remember rightly, dates from 1999. And as you can tell, predates a lot of the online research investigators would have been conducting, and certainly the social media investigations they would have been conducting. And so it doesn't specifically really regulate their activities in that area. There's been a lot of talk about the recent, you know, so-called Snoopers Charter, the Investigatory Powers Act, which actually only covered the interception of communications and didn't cover open source intelligence or social media investigation. So it hasn't been a change in formal law. It has, as Matt's alluded to, been a shift in professional practice, and that is still very varied. So some of the comments that I heard from talking to people within law enforcement in the UK when investigating this sort of issue was that for some agencies, they are trying to take a very cautious approach to it. So they're very wary of falling foul of any sort of any of their prosecutions sort of falling apart in court because they haven't captured their evidence correctly, or they've gone beyond the remit of OSINT and failed to get the right authorizations, etc. Whereas others are taking a far more, you know, perhaps proactive stance, and they're saying, well, actually, let's treat everything as open source, and unless we know it is definitely surveillance, in which case we will apply for an authorization. So there's a difference in approach, and in looking briefly at some of the other international jurisdictions, seeing the same things occurring in other countries as well. So there's a real difference in approach to investigations and the capture of evidence from online investigations particularly, which could affect sort of particularly cross-border prosecutions. So it's something that law enforcement agencies probably need to look into in their use of OSINT.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. We have another question. Do these gray areas of open source intelligence also have a potential dangerous trend as non-state groups acting against the state as some of these technologies become less the proprietary ownership of states and potentially acquired by threat groups? So in short, can states keep a lid on the technology even if it's open source?
That's absolutely the case. You know, there are documented examples of Islamist terrorist groups in Syria using tools such as Google Earth to call in artillery strikes and things like that. You know, the technology is there, it is available, and even though something like Google Earth, for example, is theoretically banned in Syria or is not accessible in Syria, there are ways and means that obviously you can subvert that system and get hold of the technology. So yes, absolutely. And what we see as well, I mean, if you look at a lot of the larger groups, if you look at a group such as Hezbollah, for example, Hezbollah has a very well-developed counterintelligence function. It has a very well-developed espionage function. You know, to all intents and purposes, it functions like a state would. So it has all of those functions, and it can do things such as carrying out communications interception and so on. There's kit that's coming onto the market, again, for signals interception or for communications interception, which 10, 20 years ago would only have been used by nation states. If you add to that then, of course, something like the growth of encryption, this is something that the agencies have complained about since the Snowden revelations, is that a lot of threat actors are going dark. We've talked about the dark web, which appears to have conveniently funneled a lot of threat actors into one area where enforcement takedown has then been quite successful. But then they're moving on to these things such as encrypted messaging apps. That's all, it's all out there, it's all available, and a lot of things that are being developed are done with open code. And that provides the sort of facility to resist law enforcement attention that wasn't there previously. So the question is excellent, and it obviously applies to non-state groups as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So unless there's any other questions in the chat, I wanted to thank everyone for attending today. Our next session will be held on February 20th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and we're going to have Dr. Sabrina Margris from the Operative Intelligence Research Center at Ecole University International in Italy presenting on hostage negotiation and intelligence-based approach. So thank you both, Rob and Terry, for joining us today, and we look forward to continuing to work with you in the future. I know we had a lot of people in chat say that they were going to reach out to you, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep, feel free to contact us. We look forward to, you know, any follow-up questions you might have.